Well, this is Plan B. It's on the other Mark's Eleanor, and it was originally given to one of our Sunday afternoon meetings on dangerous women. Now, I mean, not a lot of people know that Marx had a daughter who was an active socialist writer and agitator in her own right. And Marx and his wife had three children who survived into adulthood, all of them daughters. The eldest, Jenny, was born in France. The second, Laura, was born in Belgium. And the third, Eleanor, was born in England in 1855. And she was 10 years younger than Laura. Although she was born and brought up in England, she went to a school here in South Hampstead, in fact, because at the time, Marx was living in a Kentish town. Now, both her sisters married Frenchmen and lived in France. She was Marx's political secretary till he died in 1883, as well as looking after him after her mother had died in 1881. Now, after his death, she earned a living from translating and tutoring. She was the first to translate Flaubert, Madame Bovary, into English. But above all, she translated Ibsen's plays from the Danish. I assume if you know German, you could translate from classical Danish. Which, in fact, she did a bit of amateur acting herself. Now, she committed suicide in 1898, aged only 43, when her partner of 14 years left to marry somebody else after using up all her money that she'd inherited from Engels. Now, if you want to know more about her personal life, there are two biographies of her. One is the two volumes by Yvonne Kapp, which came out in the 1970s. In fact, volume two was reviewed in the Socialist Standard in March 1977. These have just been republished. And there's a more recent one by Rachel Holmes that came out in 2014. Now, the Sunday Times, in its review of the Holmes one, opined or said, "How much better would the 20th century have been if it had been Eleanor's views on the freedom of women that had been adopted instead of her father's communism?" Now, this is wrong on two counts. First, of course, communism in Marx's sense was not achieved anywhere in the 20th century. But second, Eleanor was a communist, or socialist, as it had become known by the 1880s. She was a communist or socialist in the same sense that her father was. I'll give you a couple of examples. When her father died in 1883, she wrote a two-part obituary of him. The second part explains his labor theory of value and surplus value, and it's quite good. But remember that at that time, Capital had not been translated into English, only into French. Incidentally, the writings by and about her I mentioned, I put in the useful links column. And she was a member of the Social Democratic Federation that had been founded in 1883, and she served on its executive committee. She was also a founder member of the Breakaway Socialist League and signed one of the signatories of its manifesto, which began, "Fellow citizens, we become before you as a body advocating the principles of revolutionary international socialism. That is, we seek to change the basis of society, a change which would destroy the distinctions of classes and nationalities." The second example is in a review in 1886 of the English translation of Babel's Woman and Socialism, she wrote that socialism will be, I quote, "a society in which all the means of production are the property of the community, and that the first step to this is the expropriation of all private property in land and in all other means of production. With this would happen the abolition of the state as it now is." Now, when the Socialist League was taken over by anti-parliamentary anarchists, well, actually they were bomb-throwing anarchists. When this happened in 1888, she left and involved herself in organising the unskilled workers, the gas workers, dockers, match girls, and so on, involved in new unionism, as it was called. She attended International Social Democratic and International, where she acted as one of the interpreters, because obviously she spoke French and German as well as English. She was also the executor of her father's literary works, including the famous talk that he gave to English trade unionists in 1865, Value, Price and Profit, which ends with Marx saying that instead of the conservative slogan of a fair day's work for a fair day's wages, a fair day's wages for a fair day's work. It was Harold Wilson that turned that round and told workers they were getting fair wages to work a fair day. And then instead of that slogan, they should have the trade union should adopt the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wages system. She translated some of his writings from German into English and also from French, Lisa Gary's History of the Paris Commune and Plekhanov's Anarchism and Socialism. She rejoined the Social Democratic Federation in 1896 and was a member at the time of her tragic death in 1898. Now, what about the second part of the Sunday Times comment on the view on the freedom of women? She was what today would be called a feminist, that is, someone who stood for the equality of the sexes in all aspects of public and private life. But the term was not in use in that sense in the 1880s. Of course, this is what socialists had always stood for in principle since the utopian socialist Charles Fourier in 1824. But in the 1880s and 1890s, the women's equality had become a live political issue. On the Marxist Internet Archive file of her writings, incidentally, there's a link to that also on Useful. There are two in particular on this issue. One, it's the review I already mentioned of the English translation of Babel's book on women in socialism. And the other, a report on the discussion at the 1896 Congress of the German Social Democratic Party, which discussed what was called the woman question at that time. But before having a look at what she I want to make the point that she practiced what she preached. I mean, she lived for 14 years till her death with a man without getting married, to start with, while he was still legally married. I mean, this was scandalous behavior for the time, so she was being very brave, even though it ended in tragedy. I mean, polite society, even fellow socialists, referred to her as Mrs. Aveling, and she signed herself Eleanor Marx Aveling. Nobody called her Miss Marx. So the title of that film is a bit, well, I can see why they did it, but it's misleading. Incidentally, I don't know whether Aveling is pronounced Aveling, but in the party, I've always heard it pronounced Aveling. Now, she clashed with Belfort Bax, who was a prominent member of both the Socialist League and then again of the Social Democratic Federation. But he actually wrote some acceptable stuff, I mean, copies of which are in the party's library. However, he was an opponent of equal rights, including the vote for women. I mean, basically, he was a misogynist. Eleanor accused him of womanphobia, a term which doesn't seem to have catched on. He called her a feminist, which is one of the earliest use of the term in its modern sense. Now, as a barrister, he disguised this in clever terms. On the Marxist Internet Archive site, there's an article he wrote for Justice, which was the organ of the Social Democratic Friends, in July 1895 on the woman question. In it, he lists what he regarded as legal privileges enjoyed by women, such things as not having to work at night or down coal mines, but he concentrated on two in particular, that a husband was legally responsible for his wife's debts and that a woman could freely leave a man, but if a man left a woman, he was required by law to pay for her upkeep. In fact, it was a criminal offence not to do so. This was the law at the time. But of course, what he didn't realise was that this confirmed the dependence of women on a man. This is a point Eleanor and her co-author Aveling made in the review of Babel's book. She said that it was all very well asking for and obtaining equal legal and political rights for women, but this didn't solve the problem, as the inequality between men and women had an economic origin. I mean, a married woman was economically dependent on her husband. At that time, and for many decades afterwards, the married woman was not expected to work for wages. Women who worked tended to be single and stopped working when they got married, even those working in factories. In fact, school teachers and civil servants were required to resign on getting married as part of their terms of employment. So hence the review's conclusion that only socialism could free women, because in socialism they would have independent access to what they needed to live, and so would no longer be economically dependent on a man if they chose to live with one. Now, this is a good argument, which perhaps has less force today, when in Britain a majority of members of the working class, people who work for wages, are women. It's still valid, of course, that in the socialist society, in socialism, women would not need to live with a man for money or economic security, as many still do today. In fact, I'm surprised that campaigning organisations for women's rights, such as the Women's Equality Party, that they don't realise this. But then, of course, like many other, so they don't see beyond capitalism. Let me now comment on Clara Zetkin's speech on women question at the Congress of the German Social Democratic Party, which took place in Goethe in 1896. Eleanor entirely agreed with what Zetkin said, and the German party adopted. So what in fact did Clara Zetkin say? Well, first, that there was a different women's question for women of the proletariat, of the bourgeoisie, of the intelligentsia, and of the upper class, or the upper 10,000, as she called them. These latter, those of the ruling class, did not have so much of a problem because of their wealth. Although we could argue, though Zetkin didn't, that they still had a campaign to keep their property on marriage and to inherit titles and wealth. Then, this is Eleanor's words, I'm quoting, Frau Zetkin passed on the middle and petty middle-class woman. Here comes the true struggle against man, and in the text, against is in italics. Here, the educated woman, the doctor, the clerk, the lawyer, is the antagonist of man. The women of this class are sick of their moral and intellectual subjugation. They are Noras rebelling against their dolls' homes. They want to live their own lives, and economically and intellectually, the demands of the middle-class women are fully justified. As I said, she put this emphasis on as a struggle against man. As to the proletarian woman, this is Eleanor summarizing Clara Zetkin again, as to the proletarian women, their struggle was not against men, but with men against employers for better wages and working conditions, socialist reforms, social reforms, and in the end, for socialism. Actually, in her speech, Zetkin did not say that what she called the bourgeois women's movement was a struggle against men, i.e. against all men. She only said that there was competition between men and women for professional jobs. Nor did she use the word subjugation in relation to bourgeois women wanting to develop their individuality. She did, however, say that the economic as well as the intellectual and moral endeavour of bourgeois women's rights advocates are completely justified. We want to contest that. But that, I don't know, should have summarised Zetkin's view in the way she did, reveals her personal feelings. She was, after all, herself an educated woman, and she had chosen not to live in a doll's house and clearly resented the unequal treatment that educated women were getting compared with educated men. If that was indeed Eleanor's position, it represents a difference from Clara Zetkin's. I'm sure you'll all like the title of Zetkin's speech, which is on the archives, entitled "Only in conjunction with the proletarian woman will socialism be victorious." In any event, the position was inconsistent. You can't draw a distinction between the position of educated women and proletarian women. If educated women were in competition with men for jobs, so surely were proletarian women. And if the intellectual and moral endeavors of educated women were subjugated by men, then so were those, or so would be those, of proletarian women. Of course, so I'm just going to sum up now, whatever the reason for women's unequal treatment, whether subjugation, discrimination, unfair competition, or the weight of history, however you want to describe it, demanding equal treatment is justified. But then the question arises, how best to do this as an independent movement within capitalism or as part of the movement for socialism? Okay, thanks.
I've got a quick question for Adam, just in the meantime. I was reading Keir Hardie's biography by Caroline Benn. I don't know whether you've come across that, Adam. But there's lots of references in that about Eleanor Marx's influence on Keir Hardie. I don't know what you thought about that.
Well, I suppose it's possible, because Keir Hardie was in the Independent Labour Party while Eleanor Marx was in the rival Social Democratic Federation. I mean, she was active, as I say, in new unionism, you know, especially the gas work and the Dockers. So I suppose she could have come across Keir Hardie, or he could have come across her, but I haven't heard of any direct influence of her on him. But,
sorry, Steve, I think...
Please. Yeah, just, I mean, this is a bit of an aside, isn't it? A sister committed suicide. The one that was partner of Lafargue. Well, they both committed suicide later on.
Yes, it's a bit unfortunate to have commit suicide, but fortunately not your own lifetime. But I think the case of Laura and Paul Lafargue is they didn't have any children, and they were growing old, so they had a suicide pact, I suppose. I mean, I take it that Paul didn't say to her, "You have to die with me," but I mean, they might have decided that was the, you know, to do it. So only one of Marx's daughters, Eugenie, the oldest, had children, and they're still around. Although, I mean, their descendants are called Longway after Jenny Marx's his husband. One of them was an active member of the French Socialist Party, in inverted commas. And when the split came in 1921, over who was going to support the Bolsheviks and who was going to remain loyal to social democracy, he didn't join the Bolsheviks, which would be nice to think that Eleanor Marx wouldn't have done, as opposed to Clara Zetkin. I think she stayed with the communists for sentimental reasons, but she happened to be the oldest member of the Reichstag when Hitler was appointed chancellor, so she got the chance to make a speech putting the case against him. But anyway, Marx's descendants are only through his eldest daughter, Jenny.
Okay, I think it's Darren there.
I apologise, I was late to the meeting. I was expecting a different talk. Can Adam just give me like a one sentence description of what he just spoke on? Because he basically just finished as I logged on.
I guess, Adam.
You know, Wes had prepared his talk with the music illustrations, but there were technical problems when they did it this afternoon. So that's been postponed until later. But we have a plan B in operation when this happens. And the plan B happens to be a talk I gave on Eleanor Marx earlier on. So that's what the talk was about how Eleanor Marx, well, was a Marxist, if you like, was a socialist, and also her views on the woman's question and feminism. So that's what the talk is about. That's what happened. This is Plan B. But the talk on music will take place later on, probably in June, but maybe in May. I don't know yet.
Okay, guys, just one quick question, because obviously it's a bit ignorant of me, like, comment on something I didn't hear. But did you mention, as I'd mentioned at the last meeting, did you mention the film that was just released about Eleanor Marx that just came out in the last year, I believe? It's an Italian production, but it's actually in English with English actors, or British actors.
Yes, it was mentioned, only by me anyway, criticised the title. It's called Miss Marx. And Eleanor was never known as Miss Marx. Well, she might have been when she was in school. But because she was living with Edward Abeling, she was known as Mrs. Abeling. And she called herself Eleanor Marx Abeling. I haven't seen the film, but I've seen the trailer. It's a trendy thing, I think. But I don't know, maybe we could get hold of a copy and show. But I think it seems to be mainly about taken in by this scoundrel or cad, whatever they were called in those days, Edward Abeling, who used up all her money and well, left her in a position in the end where she. You can understand why she committed suicide. I mean, he'd taken all her money, and he destroyed her reputation and humiliated her. And so his name was Mud in the socialist movement afterwards, and nobody went, no socialist or social democrat went to his funeral. But the ironic thing is that he died about 4 months after she'd committed. Well, perhaps that's some sort of justice.
Okay, Mike.
Cheers. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it was interesting to hear more about Eleanor Marx, who I'm ashamed to admit I didn't sort of know much about beforehand. So yeah, thanks for that. I don't know if it's fair to ask you, Adam, to maybe sort of make a prediction and consider that with her being prominent in the SDF, what do you think her attitude would have been had she lived an extra 20 years for when the SPGB started? What do you think her attitude would have been had she been around towards us? Cheers, thanks.
Well, she would have only had to live for another 6 years or so. She would have Our party was formed, but I think I think she would have agreed with the people, if you like, the left wing people that stayed in the SDF, because I don't think she'd have agreed any more than Marx himself did, for that matter, with not advocating social reforms as well as socialism. I reckon she would have stayed a member of the Social Democratic Federation or Social Democratic Party, as it later became. But of course, the other interesting thing is, what would she have done acted towards the Bolshevik Revolution? Because she wouldn't have been all that old at that point. But as I say, it's all speculation. But I think she reflected or stuck to the same idea on most things. So I'm not sure. We've always joked that Marx would not be admitted to the SPGB, but William Morris would be, but would soon be expelled.
Oh, cheers. Yeah, thanks. And yeah, I've just realised I got my dates wrong. Yeah. Cheers. Thank you.
Okay, Howard?
Adam, I was going to ask you this question before you answered Darren earlier, and you sort of answered the question I was going to ask them, but my question was, could you tell us a bit more about the politics of the man she committed suicide over, Edward Abeling? But you've sort of said a bit about that. Is there anything more to be said about him?
Oh yes, quite a bit. He was a propagator of Charles Darwin's views. He was trained as some sort of biologist. And he wrote lots of tracts and pamphlets promoting atheism I think he was at one time the editor of the Free Thinker, which is the organ of the National Secular Society. So he was well known in his own right as a popularizer of Darwin's ideas. And he also wrote summaries of Marx in economics and so on. He was also a member of the Social Democratic Federation, and then the Socialist League, and then the Social Democratic Federation again. So his politics were also, you know, that of the Social Democratic Federation. So I don't know, he wasn't, you know, just whatever he was, scoundrel and a cad. He wrote plays as well. So I mean, we can look him up. I suppose he's an interesting person in his own right to a certain extent.
Okay, there doesn't seem to be. Darren was there in the queue, but he's withdrawn his question. So I had a couple of questions, Adam, which was when they talk about Eleanor Marx, they were saying that she was dedicated for a substantial part of her life supporting Marx, you know, on his various works. You didn't mention that a great deal. Maybe is that been overblown? And then the other question I had was, which is I've got no knowledge of, is was her involvement with the Social Democratic Party in Germany. Did she have much involvement with Rosa Luxemburg before the fatal event? She seems to be around at the same time. So a couple of questions there.
I don't think you can say she developed a great part of her life to look at. He died in 1883, and her mother and his wife died in 1881. So it was between 1881 and 1883 that she would be looking after her father, but not just looking after her. She was his political secretary during that period. So I don't think you can say that you know, she sacrificed her life to look after her father. Rosa Luxemburg was 15 years her junior. I mean, she was born in 1855, and Rosa Luxemburg was born in 1870. So I don't think Rosa Luxemburg was on the scene, or she's just coming on the scene, just as Eleanor Marx was committed suicide from about 1898. So I don't think they did know each other, but she was great friends with Clara Zetkin, who was born. I think they're both about the same age, so they, I mean, they got on quite well together and visited each other in Germany.
So, Darren, you've got a question now.
Well, yeah, I've got a question. I just, for the people who want to speak. One thing is, I put a link to the movie in the general links. It's a Russian website, but it's okay. You know, if you want to watch the film on your the Miss Marx movie on your laptop, you can. It's in English, but there is subtitles underneath, but they don't interfere too much. Just, I guess, asking Adam, I didn't hear the talk, but you mentioned the business about if Eleanor Marx had lived like another 7 or 8 years, how she would have responded to the Impossibilist revolt in the Social Democratic Federation. Did you touch upon, you know, her involvement in the, I guess you could make a case for it being the first Impossibilist revolt in the SDF, the Socialist League forming in, is it 1884, 85? Because she alongside like Bax and Morris and Aveling, was part of that split from the SDF. And though I'm not as cuddly towards William Morris and the Socialist League as most members of the party, there's definitely an overlap there between like our sort of impossibilism and what the Socialist League tried to forward in the 1880s before it did kind of like you know, taken over by the anarchists, or, you know, members went back to the SDF. I mean, you mentioned that Eleanor Marx wouldn't have been sympathetic to the left-wing split in the SDF. Do you think that's because of her previous experience in the Socialist League? Had she changed in the intervening period? Was she more sympathetic to, like, a broad-based, like, Labour Party, you know? You know, I mean, just those sort of questions I'm just curious about, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I did mention that she was a member of the Social Democratic and was one of those who split off to form the Socialist League in December 1884, I think. And I quoted from their manifesto saying, we stand for revolutionary international socialism. But then she left the Socialist League before William Morris did. And she left on the issue of the League was anti-parliamentary. And she and the others left when the League voted against, took up an anti-parliamentary position. So, I mean, they were in favour of obviously participating in parliamentary elections, but presumably on a programme of, well, a minimum programme and a maximum programme. Because Morris stayed in for a further 2 years. And I mean, I know you put derogatory comments about Morris on SP Open and things, but his position was much nearer to ours than hers on this issue of campaigning for reforms. I think that, you know, to come back to the question which was asked by Mike, I mean, the big issue that came up towards the end of the century in the Social Democratic Federation was whether or not they should affiliate to the Labour Party. They voted to affiliate, and they did affiliate, but then they disaffiliated. I would reckon, my guess would be that she would have been in favour of the SDF affiliating to the Labour Party in view of her activities in the late 1880s and early 1890s in the new unionist movement of the trade unions. But I mean, this is just speculation. I mean, thought her political position would be, I don't think she would have supported the impossibilist revolt in the SDF, Hindman, because that's where one of the reasons they broke away in the first place is authoritarian attitude. And of course, some of his political positions, you know, he was an imperialist and supported the Boer War thing. But I think she was an orthodox social democrat, left wing social democrat.
Well, there doesn't seem to be any more people in the queue just at the moment. I have a very basic question. Could you explain to the uninitiated, Adam, what this the impossibilist revolt is regarding the SDF in Germany, and what was it about, just briefly?
Yeah. Well, Darren could answer this as well as I could. No, the impossibilist revolt was in England. It was in the Social Democratic Federation. And it was a revolt against Hindman and his clique, first of all, for being a clique and controlling it, but secondly, for some of their policies of doing deals with the liberals and people like that to try to get elected. And there were two parts of it. One was in London, mainly in London, and they broke away in 1940. Great Britain. There was another group in Scotland, which broke away the year before and formed the Socialist Labour Party of Great Britain. I think James Connolly was associated with that for a while. And they modelled themselves on the American Labour Party and Daniel DeLeon. But I mean, those two were the outcome of the impossibilist revolt in Britain. I mean, I should really hand over to Darren here, because the early party members thought they were kindred spirits in France and in Germany and in other social democratic parties, and they were, but very few of them came to the same position as we did on not advocating reforms. I mean, they were critical of the reformism or which the parties had fallen into, or they were just it was a sort of lip service to capitalism. But they weren't exactly on the same wavelength. Party members found out within a few years. But even so, they were still publishing stuff from people in France and Kautsky and people like that from other social democratic parties. But incidentally, this talk was given to in a series called, I was going to say Desperate Woman, but I think it's Dangerous Woman. So I mean, people are free to talk about feminism if they want to. But
Adam, have you finished there? That was a bit abrupt.
Yeah, I was just saying we can discuss a wider discussion. Just discussing Eleanor Martin. We've been discussing her views so far on socialism, but she also had a position on what was called the woman question at the time. I mean, I think she got it wrong when she said that at least the struggle of educated women was a struggle against men, which is a position which, well, some people have taken up. I don't think it's a position that Clara Zetkin took up. So there's a slight difference there between these two women. But as I say, this talk was originally given in that context.
Yeah. Okay, Adam, I would say that your mic, you're breaking up quite often. I don't know whether that's some issue that you're aware of, but it's a little bit disconcerting. Perhaps you could have a look at your mic.
I am aware of it. That's why I'm box here.
Okay, I missed the last bit of that. We've got John, is it? John Carter?
Janet.
Sorry, Janet.
It's okay. This is quite...
Please, give me a break.
Quite a lightweight contribution in comparison to what the others will make, but I've always been rather cross with Eleanor Marx for committing suicide and very angry with Edward Aveling for treating her in that way. So mine's a sort of more like a personal feeling of she could have supported herself, I'm sure, even though he did run off with all of her money. I think she could have earned a living. Maybe it wouldn't have been at a level that she was used to living at, possibly, I guess. But I think probably as a writer, she could have earned a living. So I do feel that this psychological dependence that some of us have on others, and maybe that came into it, or the feeling of shame in society because he treated her in the way he did. I feel it was a tragedy, really, that she allowed herself to be undermined by him. And I think it's something that's still going on, otherwise you wouldn't hear all this so much, this business of violence against women. So it's a digression from what we're really talking about into the social situations of men and women. And it's interesting to speculate, but not really for here, I suppose. So I'll leave it at that.
No, I think that's quite a valid question. I'm sure you want to respond to that, Adam.
Yeah, well, I agree. It is a valid question. I mean, if you were a single woman in those days, and I mean, she could have earned a living before, she got money from Engels and so on. As a translator, I mean, she translated quite a few books from French, and she translated quite a lot of Ibsen's plays. If you look on the Marxist Internet Archive site at the bottom, they've got a list that she translated. So she could have gone as a when she was younger as a tutor and a translator. The thing in the 19th century, men tended to learn Latin and Greek, and women tended to learn modern languages. So, for instance, going back a bit further, George Eliot translated Feuerbach's thing on Christianity. So, I mean, that would have been all she would have been able to have done. But I think you're right. She did live comfortably. Well, I mean, so did Marx, for that matter. I mean, she had a servant, and it was a servant that went out to buy the poison for which she used to poison herself. So she was, well, she was an educated woman, relatively well off. They were living in Sydenham. I don't know what Sydenham is like today, but I suppose in those days it would have been a respectable suburb. But yeah, I think you're right. I don't suppose it was purely financial that she did it. It would have been psychological. It would have been, I imagine, the humiliation. But it was always a brave thing that she was doing, and you know, living with a man without being married. I mean, other women that tried this got put into psychiatric things by their family. So. As I say, the whole thing's a tragedy. But
have you finished there, Adam? Again, you stopped.
Well, okay. Well, yeah, I have finished.
Okay, Paddy.
I was interested. I wanted to go back to this question of where socialism, well, in a broad sense, if we include, you know, people like Eleanor Marx, their sort of view of socialism, how it kind of, and how she got accused of being a feminist by Belfort Bax. And, you know, there's a kind of a historical narrative over the 20th century in some circles about how, you know, the sort of socialist perspective, again, if we're defining it in broad terms, sort of, you know, decoupled from the feminist perspective at the point where, you know, sort of radical women started to feel that socialist circles just, you know, weren't really for them, didn't really sort of, you know, well, they were basically excluded, or they felt excluded, or they felt that they didn't fit. And I was just, what I was wondering was, I don't know if anybody's read that Belfort Bax thing on women. I read it ages ago. It is really quite shocking. I mean, Adam's absolutely right. You know, the guy was a complete misogynist. But I was just wondering, well, you know, at that time, how much was that? Would that have been a tolerated view amongst members of the SDF? I mean, this bearing in mind that Darren's favourite person, William Morris, I mean, he was upbraided for the fact that in News from Nowhere, all the women were in the kitchen. You know, I mean, how much was this kind of, you know, it's sexism endemic within these sort of socialist circles at that time? You know, was it tolerated? It's because, you know, how could people, you know, they cold-shouldered Edward Aveling, basically because he didn't behave like a gentleman, he didn't behave like the way a man should, but nobody cold-shouldered Belfort Bax for being a misogynist. You know, I wonder what Adam's view about that is, about, you know, the level to which this kind of, you know, gender discrimination was tolerated at that time.
No, I think Belfort Bax was out on his own. He was an eccentric. I don't think he had any support for his views. But people were probably reluctant to criticize him because he was one of the major theorists of the Social Democratic Federation. I mean, that read German and understood Hegel and Marx and that, and he wrote stuff on that, and he wrote books on the Paris Commune, on the French Revolution. I mean, if you read his other books, they're all right on other subjects. I mean, you could recommend some of them, but on this particular thing, I think he was out on his own. I don't know whether I can't see the people of the time being explicitly anti-women or think women's place was in the home or in the kitchen. I suppose maybe in their attitudes they might have been, but they wouldn't have been explicit on this, because after all, right? I mentioned I'll pronounce it in English way, Charles Fourier in the 1820s and the some Salonians and people like that, they were all in favor of female emancipation, and that was inherited by scientific socialists, if you like. And the preamble to the the International Working Men's Association says that it stands for the emancipation exactly the same, you know, without distinction of race or sex, which is where we would have got it from. So I mean that principle would have been asserted, but I'd say whether in practice it was carried out in everyday relations between men and women, I don't know. But anyway, they did regard Aveling as a cad, but they still called her Mrs. Aveling.
Okay, I think it's Howard.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, I was going to refer to something Adam has just referred to, which is Clause 4 of our Declaration of Principles, of which, you know, we always express our great pride, because it says the emancipation of the working class will involve the emancipation of all mankind without distinction of race or sex. So we say that sort of we always say we were feminists avant la lettre. Presumably there were sort of others in 1904 when that Declaration of Principles was written and agreed by the impossibilists who broke away from the SDF. Presumably that's the way people regarded themselves. But, I'm not sure Adam has got this information. If Adam hasn't, maybe Darren has. When the party was formed in 1904, there were obviously quite a few sort of socialists who were women rather than men. I mean, what kind, you know, if I can just connect this up with today, we're often lamenting the fact that the party has got a relatively small percentage of women in its ranks, although it hasn't always been the case. I mean, in the sort of 70s and 80s, there were a far greater proportion of women in the party than there are now. But nevertheless, women have always been a minority. I mean, I wonder what the sort of proportions were when the party was set up in 1904. Anybody know? Do you know, Adam or Darren?
Well, no, there were some women in, because there's a photo conference in 1904 with, I think, two women in it. But I'll defer to Darren because he's got some say on this, I think.
Okay, there's Freddie, but Darren, I guess you seem to be the man to jump the queue there.
No, I don't mind that. If Darren wants to come in, he can come in.
Freddie should speak, sorry.
Okay, then, thanks. Listen, maybe not particularly interesting question to you, Adam, but I think I picked you up saying that you'd actually seen part, maybe not all of it, but part of the film. And if I picked that up correctly, what did you actually think of the sort of historical accuracy of the film? I appreciate you may not have seen it all, but if you have seen some of it, what did you actually think of it? And do you think it's a film that may come out on general release? Thanks.
No, I hadn't seen the advertisement for it and a review of it. But it's a bit avant-garde, I think. It's got punk music and things like that. So not really my cup of tea, but we'll have to see when it comes out. I think somebody said it can be looked on a Russian on a Russian site. But I mean, as I say, all I've gone, I didn't even know it had come out until Paddy mentioned it to me. So all I criticised was the title, I don't know. A lot of it is to do with her and Aveling, I think.